Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Plotlines. I'm your host, Connor. And today I have a guest, Mr. Joseph Pierce. We're going to talk about the Chronicles of Narnia. Welcome, Mr. Pierce.
My pleasure to be here.
We were just talking beforehand about, what the right way of reading the Chronicles of Narnia, is. And, personally, I don't really know. Because I read it first, or when I read it first, I read starting with The Magician's Nephew. And then I learned later that the publication order was different. So what do you think, Professor Pierce?
Well, the first thing is that we have to insist that there's no definitively objective right answer to the question. The choice we have to make is, do we want to read the books in the order in which they were written by C.S. Lewis? Or do you want to read the books in the order of the story chronologically within the work of fiction? So the way that the book is, that the Chronicles of Narnia are normally marketed these days is in the order of the story, the fictional story. So therefore it begins with Magician's Nephew, which is obviously the creation of Narnia, and ends with the last battle, which is obviously the apocalypse and the end of Narnia, or rather the beginning of Narnia, in the sense that it now exists in eternity. This is my position, and on the understanding that it's a subjective opinion and not an objective statement of the right and correct way of doing things. So essentially, if you're reading the Chronicles of Narnia from the perspective of scholarship, so if you're a scholar and you want to understand the C.S. Lewis's engagement with the creative process, you want to understand C.S. Lewis's development of ideas from one book to the other and how the story grows in his imagination and finds its way onto the page, and obviously it's crucial that you read the works and understand the works in the order in which C.S. Lewis wrote them. And certainly there are certain type of C.S. Lewis purists that will insist that you have to read them in that order. I beg to differ. I think if you're a scholar, you should read them in that order. If, however, you're reading for pleasure, leisure, recreation, or to your children, then it makes more sense to read the story in the order in which the events happen chronologically, which means that I have no make chronologically within the story, not chronologically within the order of composition. So I have no problem with the way that HarperCollins now market the books, beginning with The Magician's Nephew, ending with The Last Battle. Except even then, I personally, as a pure subjective preference with my own reading, both as regards myself, but also as regards reading it to my children, I begin with The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And then I will take the other six in the order of the story. And the reason, my reason for that is I think that we are meant to enter Narnia, first of all, through the wardrobe with Lucy. So, and that's where we understand when Narnia was first created and how sin first entered Narnia and how it's connected to our own world. So I think that personally speaking, you enter Narnia through the wardrobe by reading The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe first, and then read The Magician's Nephew, and then take the other books in the order of the story thereafter.
Yeah, no, it's a very nuanced perspective. And I think all three of those perspectives regarding, order being the publishing order, or the story order, or even just starting with the wardrobe and then going in order. I think all of them have really interesting merits to them and uses. And it's interesting with my generation. I was very much you could argue poison depending by the fact that a lot of my generation received their first glimpse of Narnia through the movies instead of being able to probably grow up with the books, just because of the generational style, I guess.
Word from our affiliate, Bishop Sheen Rosaries. You've probably worn through the chain of your cheap plastic rosary. Other rosaries simply can't stand up to the wear and tear of everyday life. Bishop Sheen rosaries are made of solid metal beads and paracord to withstand any condition, and are backed with a lifetime warranty. Upgrade your rosary to a Bishop Sheen rosary made to fit your lifestyle, or buy one for a friend. Each rosary sold supplies 2 weeks of food for a school kid in Uganda. You use the exclusive link down below to help support our efforts here at Plotlines. The link will take you to sheenrosaries.com. Be sure to use the code PLOTLINES10.
Yeah, I mean, speaking as a member of the older generation, the much older generation than the people such as your generation, you know, I really do feel that the modern generation has been handicapped by its being shackled to video culture. And let me explain what I mean by that, is that there's a creative dynamic that exists, an imaginative dynamic that exists between the writer of a work of literature and the reader of a work of literature, because you have the words, but the words merely invite the reader to conjure up pictures in their imagination. It's creative dynamic engagement between the writer and the reader. So we get a picture in the Chronicles of Narnia in the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe of Lucy and Mr. Tumnus, who are being told the conversation, and they're walking through the woods and they go to his house. And that we are filling in, you know, what the words are only suggesting. When we watch a video, instead of having this active creative engagement, we are invited to sit back and chill out and basically let... it's a passive experience where we let the vision be provided for us, of being spoon-fed. We don't actually need to use our own imaginations. It's all being done for us. It's not the same experience of the work. But the other thing is, when we then go to read the work, our imaginations have been gatecrashed by the visual experience of watching the adaptation. We don't see Lucy and Mr. Tumnus as our imagination conjure them up. When we read C.S. Lewis's words, we see the actors that played those roles in the adaptation. We can't help but see the way that that was, I would even say, manipulated, adapted by the producers and directors. The way they've seen it is the way we are now seeing it. Rather than giving us the freedom to see it, obviously, we don't have absolute freedom. We have to see it in relation to what's being shown by the author. But we don't need this interloper, this gate crasher coming in and saying, this is how you need to see it. So I'm not saying we shouldn't watch films. I'm not saying we shouldn't watch film adaptations. But I am saying, with great literature, as a golden rule, we should make a point of reading the work before we watch the adaptation. Because then we can judge the adaptation from the perspective of our imaginative engagement with the work of literature, rather than the other way around, where we're no longer able to enjoy the work of literature because we're seeing the way that it's been projected upon us passively, or our passive acceptance of this projection of it, which is what the film does, if we're not protected from it by having a knowledge of the text already.
I wonder if there's anybody that's learned to sort of fight that instinct for, you know, like, regarding my generation, is like knowingly trying to dismiss, you know, a movie and trying to, you know, only use what, like, you know what I mean? Only use what is on the page to guide your imagination. Cause, you know, it would be, I feel like someone needs to figure out a strategy to do that, because there's just so many people that have been sort of gatecrashed that way, you know, have been.
I mean, you have to know there's a problem before you can start to fix it. Mm-hmm. So what's needed is for people of your generation to say, well, hold on for a second. We're living our entire existence in a virtual reality and not a real reality, that we somehow have to, first of all, know the difference between the two. And after that, try to experience more of our lives in primal reality. and not in virtual reality, and being able to judge the latter from the perspective of the former. Because otherwise, we're never seeing the real, we're only ever seeing the virtually real, and the virtually real isn't real by definition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely interesting. For example, like I read The Hobbit before I watched any of the movies, and I could not, I mean, they were, in my opinion, The Hobbit movies are pretty bad. But like specifically, like I think because I read the book first, it was exhaustively bad. Like it was, I just could, like, I was so disappointed. And so, you know, I feel like that's probably a lot of people, even though the Lord of the Rings movies are much better, I imagine they still felt some level of that, because it's, you know, it can't live up to what your imagination is.
No, it can't. But certainly, I agree with you. The Lord of the Rings movies, Peter Jackson was doing his best to keep with the spirit of Tolkien's work. And there are failures, but there were also great successes. And I'm happy to watch and rewatch. In fact, I've scheduled three successive movie nights with some friends to rewatch them. The Hobbit films, I saw the first one and was appalled and was told the second one was worse, and thought, well, I'm not going to bother to waste my time. So yes, of course, having read the books, the Hobbit films are obviously a dereliction, a desecration even. But the other thing is, you are protected from that abuse of a work if you've read the work. Otherwise, you're ignorant of it. Now, the only thing is, if you haven't read the work, would you want to read the work having watched those films? Probably not. In fact, you'd probably think the work was not worth reading, which would be an example of something which is emphatically not the case.
Yeah, I think it's created a great, like a huge laziness problem too. People are just not, people are way more willing to just sit back and watch whatever and not do the work that is actually required to know and to, experience reality.
Yeah, well, basically, you know, we live for the time being in time. And it's actually only a very small part of our being is the time we spend in the time being. But within time, there's one thing we can't do with time and only two things we can do with time. We can't make time. So you say make time to do something. You can't make time. The time you've given, as Gerard Manley Hopkins says in his poem, The Wreck of the Deutschland, that our lives are soft sift in an hourglass. We all have a different hourglass with a certain amount of sand in it, and it's going to pass. There's nothing we can do about it. I suppose we commit suicide, but even that is known by God. So we're going to die. But in the interim, we can't make time, because we're subject to it, but we can either take time or waste time. And for me, reading a good work of literature is taking time. It's engaging with reality so that we can go deeper into reality and become more a part of reality. And if we don't take time, the only other thing we can do with time is to waste it. And I do believe that this is not true of any one particular generation. It's just perennially true of all generations. But I do think in our technologist society, where technology has become God or a God, that we spend most of our lives, most of us spend most of our lives wasting the time that's given us and not taking the time that's given us. And that is a huge waste.
Yeah. Bringing back, you know, to Narnia, what would you say your favorite Narnia book is, if you have one?
My favorite, I think, is The Last Battle. And my main reason is the darkest, of course. And when I was reading the Chronicles of Narnia to my daughter when she was, you know, younger, you know, that you get to this book and it's so relentlessly dark for the first, 60, 70, 80 pages, I mean, most of the book, in fact, that you think, well, it's not very suitable for children, is it? I mean, it's so dark and grim. But the main reason I like it is that after they go through the stable door, because the stable door, of course, is death, And then we get this vision of the afterlife. And what Lewis does there is give us some of the most profound eschatological theology you'll find anywhere, amongst all the scholars, amongst all the theologians. You will not find a vision of the afterlife as profound and as clear as Lewis gives us within a children's story. That's the genius of C.S. Lewis. This idea of heaven going further up and further in, the idea of heaven, the idea of this life being just the cover and the title page of a book. And the real story hasn't even begun yet. The real story begins after we die. And then heaven, if we get there, is a book where every chapter, and the book goes on forever, and every chapter is better than the one before it. And there's that. And then the other metaphor he gives is of an onion. But as you peel the onion, it doesn't get smaller, it gets bigger. So as you get further and further up and further into this heavenly experience, it's expansive. And I think it's not just expansive, mm-hmm. but what you see, you become further up and further in. You have a knowledge of reality. You become the perfect you, perfected as a human person in the presence of Christ. I mean, this whole vision of what we are destined to be if we have the courage to follow the path that leads us there, which we get in the final chapters of Last Battle, is profound beyond words. How C.S. Lewis did it astonishes me.
Yeah, I think my favorite has to be The Horse and His Boy. I think sort of the Moses-esque storytelling of, getting guided your whole life by Aslan and sort of finding your way back home without knowing that you had, a home. And basically, I don't know, there's something about a long-lost king that just really, I think, drives, the soul. And I think that's where it's almost, at least I think, for the time I read it, when I read it, I think it just hit me that much harder. And I think it that whole, just the combination of a boy and a horse just is very creative and enjoyable the whole way through.
Yeah, and actually that's intriguing and interesting, because I would have said until relatively recently, several years ago, that A Horse and His Boy was my least favorite of the Narnia books, but I wouldn't say it any longer. Actually, the more that I read it and engage with it, the more that I like it. And I see those aspects of it that you highlight there. I certainly agree that the idea of the return of the king, which we see obviously in Tolkien, we see it obviously in The Horse and His Boy, we see it in the Arthurian legends, we see it in The Desire of the Jacobites in English and Scottish history. So this idea, and of course the desire for the return of the king, Jesus Christ. I agree, and I love the story, and I think it's told very well, and I love the relationship, between the horses and the people in it. I think, yeah, it's and I love the fact also that it takes us out of Narnia, in fact. And in fact, that the Pevensey mm-hmm. children are not the main focus. It's offering us a new perspective.
It was a old cameo almost, like we think about movies today with cameos, but they make almost a cameo appearance, and it's done very well, yes. Obviously. It's both, the return of the king, as well as return to a father. Shasta finds his father, and that aspect just is very warming. In The Magician's Nephew, I was thinking about it recently, aspect to have man at the beginning of creation, because for Diggory to find his way to a world that is beginning is such a curious aspect, because for the most part, or the majority of creation, man is not a part of it.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I actually, again probably my second favorite is The Magician's Nephew. And whereas we have, it's the Alpha and the Omega, right? I mean, whereas in the last battle you have the Apocalypse, and then more important than the Apocalypse, the ending of time is what happens afterwards, further up and further in. But then we have in The Magician's Nephew, the Alpha, right? It's the creation of Narnia. And we have something about Tolkien and Lewis's philosophy of myth here. Perhaps we should say a little bit about that. Tolkien and Lewis, of course, are great friends, as I'm sure you and your viewers know. But they also shared this philosophy of myth. And again, for Tolkien and Lewis, myth is not the modern meaning of the word a lie. It just means story. That the older understanding of the word myth, story. Philosophy of myth is the love of wisdom, philosophia, the love of wisdom to be found through story. So they present this. In fact, there are great parallels here between the Ainur Nindala in the Silmarillion by Tolkien and Magician's Nephew by Lewis, where you see, if you like, the minds and the creative gifts of Tolkien and Lewis being brought together and dovetailing, harmonizing. Because we have in Tolkien, of course, that the Ilúvatar, the All-Father, the father of all God, brings Middle-earth into being, brings the cosmos into being through the great music. So you have this image of God as the composer of the symphony of creation. And as we, all rational mortals, you know, of course, in Tolkien's world, not just men, but elves and hobbits, dwarves, that we are players of the music. So we are given the score, if you like, and then we play. So there's this creative interaction between the divine will bringing this beautiful symphony, this great music into being, and our cooperating with that or not. And then we have in The Magician's Nephew, we have Aslan singing Narnia into being. So with Tolkien, it's the great music. With C.S. Lewis, it's the great song of creation. So the whole idea that God is first and foremost an artist who is creative, who brings a great work of art, a great work of beauty into being in creating the cosmos. That's something which I think it is informed by Tolkien's and Lewis's profoundly orthodox Christian understanding of reality.
Yeah, and they also, you know, it makes sense that Lewis would have, a male and female character, you know, sort of be the protagonists of The Magician's Nephew, because it sort of allows for the Adam and Eve, sort of representation, within the creation story, just in a different way. And, you know, for Adam still lets evil into the world, you know, just as Adam and Eve, you know, take the fruit from the tree in Genesis, you know, Diggory.
That's very intriguing, Connor, and I'm grateful for bringing that up. But I'm going to not beg to differ, but beg to distinguo. In the sense that in Genesis, Eve initiates through being tempted. And then Adam accedes. So they're both guilty. It's not a question of who's guilty. They're both guilty. Whereas, no doubt, Diggory is the son of Adam who brings original sin into Narnia at the beginning with the help, of course, of Jadis, the White Witch, the Satan figure. And poor Polly, quite frankly, is really innocent, which you can't say of Eve. So I agree with your analogy. True. I think that we have to recognize its limits.
Yeah, no, I definitely think he changes things and makes them different, because otherwise there's no reason to write something that is just a retelling exactly of a story, you know, of a pre, of Genesis, because you can read Genesis, that, you know, so, you know, obviously there are this, you know, things that distinguish it from the story. And yes, Adam is more the problem child of the, of the story. You know, Diggory is the problem, and he, and I think it's more to set up the fact that Diggory has the issue in the story where he, you know, where his mother is the one who is sick, and he needs to sort of, he wants to help her, and by, you know, the witch gives him the, or tells him that he needs to steal the apple. I believe it's an apple, right? In the sort of Eden, in the garden, sort of set up in the, in Narnia, but he doesn't take it, doesn't steal it. He brings it to, brings it to Aslan, and the healing of his mother is still the end goal, because of his refusal to listen to the devil.
Exactly. And again, there's actually a more profound theology from C.S. Lewis here, you know, that ultimately love is always inextricably inseparable from self-sacrifice. To love is to lay down our lives for the other. Love and selfishness are not and can never be the same thing. So what the witch does, obviously playing the satanic role, is to take a good thing, which is Diggory's love for his mother, and then try to distort and disorder that in such a way as, look, if you love your mother, you have the power here to save her. You don't need Aslan, you know, you don't need to tell any of the others. And it was actually, she betrays herself because she imagines, again, evil is always ultimately self-destructive. We don't have to destroy evil because evil is always in the process of destroying itself. We just have to not become partners in the crime. So basically that she miscalculates. She thinks that Diggory is going to basically be as selfish as she is, as proud as she is, as self-centered. So when he he hears her say that, he realizes this advice, even though it's tempting, because it may well be that the apple does have the power to cure, heal his mother, that it's being manipulated by something which is self-evidently wicked, because it's he knows that Aslan's good. Everything he's seen about Aslan is good. When she says that you don't have to tell the others, you don't have to tell Polly, you don't have to tell any of the others about it, it's our secret. You know, he's basically saying, in order to have this power, you have to relinquish any real understanding of virtue. You have to become a liar. You have to become a cheat. And for that, you get what you want. There's enough virtue in Diggory to realize that can't be right. And I'm going to overcome the temptation that the apples, but like the ring in the Lord of the Rings here, right? This has great power, but I know that if I use it in this way, it's ultimately wicked, and I can't serve that wickedness.
Yeah, yeah. One of my favorite moments in the book is when he first meets Aslan, and Aslan cries. I feel like that's the most, that was the most impactful moment in the book for me. I feel like it's so, I don't know how it like is more emotional than just kind of, it like, it brings to life a sort of almost something that feels more real, even though it's fiction.
Yeah, I mean, because it's the recognition by love himself of love in another, in a creature, right? And that's what we invited. The greatest gift that God gives us is the gift to be able to love. And of course, that is inseparable from the gift of freedom of the will. Because to love is to freely choose to sacrifice yourself for another person. So you can't freely choose unless you have freedom of choice. So in order for God to create lovers, and God is love, so in order to create beings that are in his image, he has to give those beings freedom. So when you understand that, when God sees true love in one of his creatures, those who are freely chosen to do as he does, you can understand how it will bring him to tears, both tears of joy and tears of sadness, tears of sorrow, because the failure to make that choice, of course, requires Aslan to do what we see Aslan doing in the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, that it's the treachery of Diggory, which brings sin into Narnia in the first place, and the treachery of Edmund in the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, which and of course the treachery of all others by extension, including you and me, beyond the story, that leads Aslan to lay down his own life for the sinner, for the not for the innocent, but for the guilty. No greater love as any man than to lay down his life for his friends. No, I'm certainly not going to contradict Christ, but no, we're not just told to love our friends, we're told to love our enemies. So no good loves any man to know that lay down his life for his enemies.
Yeah, definitely. And it's sort of the whole nature of, you know, or part of the nature of this book is sort of showing sort of a well-ordered world coming into creation. And, you know, all the animals are, you know, very much afraid, you know, that when disorder is brought into the world. And it seems, though, interesting enough that sort of at the same time it's being made, disorder is being brought in as well. That there sort of is no time in Narnia there's not a lot of time in Narnia where it's perfect, I guess.
Well, there's never a time that's perfect, because Narnia's like this world, obviously. It's a representation in fabulous fiction of our own world. And this is a fallen cosmos. That's why in all the seven stories of the Chronicles of Narnia, there's an evil to be fought and overcome. There's a price to be paid by both the innocent and the guilty for the evil that exists. But that's the reality in which we find ourselves. So, you know, that's why the Chronicles of Narnia are true stories, right? They reflect the truth of the world in which we find ourselves. You know, philosophically speaking, the fact that some of the creatures are talking beasts is accidental. It's not, you know, they're ultimately they're rational beings, and we have to treat them as rational beings. And I one thing I do like about Obi-Wan the Magician's Nephew, there's a great Chestertonian touch. And I'm forgetting now which maybe you can help me. Which creature? I think it's a bird. What it says to Aslan, have I just made the first joke?
Oh, yeah.
It's not a raven, is it?
I thought it was like a squirrel or something. It's a small, I know it's a small.
And so he says something and everyone laughs. And he says to Aslan, Aslan, have I just made the first joke? And Aslan smiles and says, no, you are the first joke. Now, and that there's something really profound about this, because, you know, Chesterton, and Lewis was a great admirer and devotee and disciple of Chesterton. Now, Chesterton, in various places, in The Man Who Was Thursday, says that God, the creation, basically, God makes these absolutely marvelous jokes in creation. He talks about the hornbill as being nothing but a preposterously small bird tagged onto the back of a huge beak. You know, that somehow or other God in his creatures is actually cracking jokes. So, you know, this idea that beneath all the sorrow, there is not just the love of God, but a God that can laugh. And again, we get really profound here, because, you know, how do we know that we're made in the image of God? No, well, we look at what makes us as human persons different from the rest of the creatures, right? We're not slaves to instinct, right? We have freedom of the will. We have the ability to love, to freely choose to lay down our lives for another. We have reason. We can work out how far it is to the sun, how long it takes light to get from the sun to us. We can reason. We also can create. We can do as God does. We can bring beautiful things into being, like the Chronicles of Narnia. So these are things that make us like God. But then you think, like, what's one other thing that we do apart from evil? Because obviously the other creatures don't commit evil, but others, so we say good thing that we do that God that makes us different from all the other creatures. Laughter. No other creature has the power and the gift of laughter. So there has to be something of the imago Dei, something of the image of God in humor itself. And therefore there is, if you like, an aspect of the joke in everything. It is actually creation, reality, as Dante tells us, it's a divine comedy, right? Because God, that's why, you know, that when Diggory enters Narnia at the moment of its creation, the god Aslan, who's about to take Narnia, had already created our world,
yeah.
Had already created Charn, which had now ceased to exist, because everything's happening in God's omnipresence. God knows. You can't ever say that God knew or God will know. You can only say that God knows. So God knows the happy ending as the author of the work of creation. God knows the happy ending for all time. So underneath, you know, beyond all sorrow, or as Samwise Gamgee says, above all shadows rides the sun.
Yeah. I feel like people will want to know hear from you more depthly. And I feel like reading your book further in is a good place to start with that. Where can people find specifically that book?
Well, further up and further in, Understanding Narnia was published by Tan Books. Okay. So I would, they go to tanbooks.com, then they will be able to buy the book from there. They want to find out what I'm doing, what I'm writing about, my own podcast, my own speaking on Tolkien and Lewis and other things, they can go to my personal website, which is jpierce.co.
I'll put it in the description as well.
Thank you so much, Connor.
And then I believe you came out with a recent book on Benedict the 16th.
I did indeed. My new book was published at the beginning of January. Is Benedict the 16th, Defender of the Faith. And basically it's an act of love on my part for a great Pope and a holy man, a great theologian, and a great defender of the truths of the Catholic faith, a great influence upon me, a great ally, of course, of St. John Paul II. Yes, it's my tribute to this great Pope.
Is it mostly a sort of a papacy, you know, like, you know, in depth on his papacy? Is that?
No, the first half of the book is about Ratzinger and the second half is about Benedict. So it's a biography of Joseph Ratzinger, looking at the most salient features of his life, the most important aspects of his legacy. So it's very accessible. The idea was people want to get to know Pope Benedict better, but don't want to pick up a 600-page academic tome. Then my book is actually a good, accessible introduction to the man, his life, his holiness, and his work.
How long is it? How many pages?
I'm not sure. I'm looking at it. I can see it from here. Let me get it. I can show you people. I can tell you. So here it is. I don't know how clearly you can see that.
Yep.
And I now tell you, as I've now got it in my hand, how many pages it is. It is just under 200 pages, 185 pages.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. That sounds like a good introduction. When I have time, I intend to get a chance to read it and maybe we could talk about that sometime, but we should wrap up right now. If there anything else before we go?
Well, no, except thanks for having me. Apologies for my voice, by the way. As you know, I've just recovered from something flu-like symptoms, and my voice is a bit croaky. So if that's come through, I apologize. But it's been a joy, as always, to spend time with you. Keep up the good work you're doing in spreading the good news about good people such as Tolkien and Lewis. And yes, I'll be happy to chat again in the future.
Okay. So thank you, everyone, for listening. Please like, share, and subscribe. Again, I'll leave links in the description to find everything regarding Joseph Pierce. And thank you for listening. Have a wonderful rest of your day. Bye.